Okay.
Okay.
There you go. We've got a lot of questions in here. So how many is in there? Oh, good. Still lots. But if I go through them very quickly, I just really want to try and make sure we get them all done this evening. So here we go, the first question. A few years ago, I had a strange experience. A few minutes after sleep, woke up without knowing the time, where I am, who I am, and other perception distortion. Then I felt a flow along my spine to my head and start to feel unusual sensation. It was so scary that my friend called an ambulance. They took me to hospital and thought I'm on drugs. They released me next day. I was okay, but I kept feel strange. A teacher one day told me about Kundalini. I spent a few months after that afraid to keep on meditating. There is such a thing as Kundalini, but I really don't recommend that. This is not really the usual time that things have a Kundalini. And what usually happens is you get nice meditation. That energy which I was talking about this morning, that tends to go into your body where it doesn't really belong there. It should stay in the mind, which is one of the reasons why if you follow the instructions properly, so you just do some letting go, your body starts to vanish, so that when you do get some energy, the very least, the very most, you are just aware of your breath when it gets very beautiful, lots of energy, even better just when you're aware of the nimitta. Then that energy goes into the mind where it belongs. It shouldn't be really going into the body. And when it does go into the body, it's always really, really unpleasant because it's mental energy going into the wrong place. And that's really Kundalini. I don't recommend that at all. But you were saying that after sleep, you woke up without knowing the time, where I am, who I am. You haven't been sort of meditating. This is just more like another experience, a bit of a dissociation. And basically, it's not really much going on there. Your friend overreacted. When anything like that happen, just let it be. I think it's the reaction to strange experiences is worse than the experience itself. I don't know what's going on. What's happening? Just relax. Let go. As Ajahn Chah used to say, you'll either get better or you'll die. It won't last. So what are you afraid of? It's the fear which causes all these panics. And the panics creates flows of energy all over the place. It's not that experience. You were just overreacted. So the next time that happens, if it happens to you, you wake up, don't know where you are. Fine. I'll soon find out where I am. If you want to know where you are, just get your smartphone and get your GPS and find out where you're located. It's really simple these days. He felt a flow along his spine to my head and start to feel unusual sensation. Great, unusual sensations are fine. Just relax and they soon disappear by themselves. So it's like the fear was the problem there, not the energy, the fear, in my opinion. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when I went to the toilet, I noticed the floor looked strange. What are they giving you and the food over here? Where's Bianca? What have you been putting in the curries? When I went to the toilet, I noticed the floor looked strange. It seems like all the micro particles moving like a wave, as if floor has melted. Not sure if it's got any significance anyway. Thought to share my experience with you. Is it still moving? Or has it stopped? Okay, those are nice little experiences which sometimes do happen in meditation. What's happening in there in those sorts of experiences is your mind gets strong. So you're getting some energy up in your mind. And it gets free from all this blinkered way of looking at life. We have been taught only to look at life in one way. And because of that, there's so many other ways of looking at life and we just can't do that. But there comes a time when those blinkers are taken off and you start to see weird stuff. I already mentioned a few things. Remember I told you about that towel which was perfectly black? Another time I was looking at the wall and it melted like chocolate on a hot day. And I'm not afraid because I know exactly what's going on. It's just perception is messing around. That's all it is. And this thing, perception, is how you interpret the world. When you go to school, you're told, you know, boy, girl, tree, cow, sun, moon. And those are actually how you've been conditioned to interpret the world. And all that conditioning, which you got so used to, you know, learning the names, learning the relationships between the names, that is now beginning to be challenged. Which is why weird things happened. But they're perfectly safe. Just relax and enjoy it. Because I say sometimes meditation can be really boring. And then you've got your eyes closed and all this weird stuff happening. You know, these sort of things start to melt and explode. That's really great because you're not allowed to watch movies, but you can watch it one in your own head. Have a great old time. This was an action. Okay, I just remembered some of the weird stuff which I had. You know, one of the strangest nimittas I had, it was a couple of years ago, I told the monks it, meditating in my cave and getting really peaceful. This beautiful light came up and it transformed into something I totally never expected. Garfield. And I saw this image, really intense, you know, all the features just really, really clear, just really brilliant. And the Garfield, the cat, because I read the cartoons. And that was the end of my meditation. I burst out laughing, couldn't stop laughing. The strangest limit I've ever seen, and that was the end of my meditation. The special Garfield limiter. You've got to be very advanced to get that. And it just, my mind was playing around. Because that's what happens. You take off all the boundaries, no control, and it throws up this weird stuff. But yeah, you just laugh at this stuff. You don't get so upset about it. The other time, okay, well, the other nimittas which I got, and this is how you deal with these things. You know, here you've got sort of strange stuff happening, things melting. What happened was, as meditation got very peaceful, and the nimitta which came up was a monster. A real, live, frightening monster, you know, with the big, bulgy eyes, like almost coming out. And teeth, not really teeth, like fangs, dripping blood, real blood, and skulls around its neck. And what else did it have? Like spiky hair. Tongue was going out as well. Right in front of me. That was really great. So what did a seasoned meditator do? This is interesting. You don't get scared. You play. Because I realize this is my perception has created this. It's not a real thing. Real monsters, demons, they can't come into this center. This is protected, this place. You know, no way can they get in this place. So even if they wanted to, they've got no business here. We're powerful beings. These are low beings. But anyway, I realized that it's just one of these perceptions. So I played with it. And what I did, it's fangs, first of all. I blacked out a few fangs, you know, just like I used to doodle on pictures when I was a schoolboy. Take out a few of its teeth so it needed to go to see the monster dentist. And then its eyes were bulging. I put Ray-Bans on it. It looked really cool, you know, like dark glasses. I couldn't see the eyes, just see these Ray-Bans, you know, sunglasses on the outside. Spiky hair, so I put sort of a hat on it. You know, a nice straw hat with a flower coming out. What else did I put a cigarette in its mouth. And actually, just by willpower, I just got the corners to go up like it was smiling. And it only took me a couple of minutes. It was really good fun. Until that monster was so ridiculous. You know, where with a few missing teeth and sunglasses on and a straw hat on the top of his head. It looked so ridiculous that I just laughed. And that was the end of the monster. Gone. I used perception. Because I can play with perception. All you need to do is suggest yourself, you know, let's imagine it with a hat on it. And a hat comes on it. So simple to do. And there was one fellow, he was staying at Bodhinyana Monastery, and he came up to me one morning, he said, I'm going crazy. He looked at the tiles, you know, on the tile veranda, and he said all these monsters were coming out of him. I said, great, this is what you should do. And so he spent a really wonderful morning, he said. I really enjoyed myself playing around with the monsters. You know, drawing things on them, putting little moustaches on them, whatever it was, until, you know, just after a while it just faded away, and that was the end of it. This is how we deal with those perceptions. We're not afraid of them. We realize these are what we create. We can actually mess around with them and have fun. Dear Ajahn, where is the cute little rabbit? That rabbit, who did it belong to? But they took it away because it was really nice, really so friendly, but it belongs to somebody. Who was it? Jesse, yeah. Oh, that's right, yeah. It's just one of the people here. They decided they liked it, so they took it and gave it a nice home. And it came back again a little while ago because she was going overseas or something. So she brought the rabbit, and the rabbit did a two-week retreat, I think. And then it went back again. So, yeah, that's a really nice little rabbit. Yeah? Are you sure it's that rabbit? Because there's lots of other rabbits around. Yeah. Because there are lots of rabbits, they live by the lake, by the where all the bushes are. There's heaps of rabbits over there. The Buddha says in Majjhima Nikaya 17, if our wholesome states decrease and unwholesome states increase, we should leave a situation. How does it work? Does it mean we should leave whenever we're not happy? If you did that, you'll never stay in your marriage. You'll never stay in your job. You won't be able to stay at school. You'll never be staying anywhere. Obviously, if you just get a little bit of decrease in wholesome states, you don't just say, right, that's it, I'm leaving. You know, you understand it first of all. What it's actually saying here is, this was especially like for monks and nuns. You know, you're in a monastery, and you don't just the first time you have a bad afternoon say, right, that's it, I'm leaving. And you stay around a little while and work with it. There was, here we go, one of the stories, if you remember this from Opening the Door of Your Heart, there was this Canadian girl whose husband had a mining contract over in West Australia for 2 years. This is about over 30 years ago now. And when they finished the contract, she was a Buddhist, he really wasn't, but she was very devout, and she used to come over and feed the monks, and when it was only 2 or 3 months. And that when the contract was over, they had to go back to Toronto, where they lived, and they were a young couple, and they thought, why go on an aircraft? Why not sort of, you know, the money we've saved, let's go and buy a little yacht, you know, a simple yacht, and with a friend, a couple of friends, go and sail all the way back to Vancouver. And in Vancouver, we can sell the yacht, and we've got the money for our house. You know, and actually, basically, that, you know, that it would be a little bit of investment, and they get the money back for the yacht back, and have like a free trip, you know, from Perth to Vancouver, and have a nice trip of a lifetime over the South Seas. It was a brilliant idea. So, financially good, and they were a young couple, just enjoy their life. So off they went, they got another couple who were going to Canada, and those two couples, they sailed all the way from Perth all the way to Vancouver. And she wrote me a letter, Janice her name was, when she arrived. And of course, there's always these wonderful stories happen. And what happened is somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, hundreds of miles from land, the engine had some trouble. It broke down. So the two guys had to go down and fix up the engine. And the two girls were on deck reading magazines, sunning themselves. This was 30 years ago, you know, when there was no equity. These days we expect the girls to be fixing the engine and the boys to be sunning themselves on deck. In your dreams, Ajahn Brahm. Anyway, there the two guys were in the engine room trying to fix things up. And if you've ever tried to fix up an engine, as I wrote in the book, I think, sometimes engines don't want to be fixed up. And they were struggling and struggling. It was really hot and cramped in there. And you get two guys getting frustrated because they can't get any progress fixing this engine in a cramped room, really hot. And they started getting irritated at each other. Hand me the wrench. No, I'm just finishing. You don't know how to fix it. Neither do you. You're hopeless. Yeah, but look at you. They, you know, the sort of stuff which happens. And it started escalating. And the curses and the bad words got worse. And they really had a huge argument. And it got so bad, they were so angry at each other, that one of these guys, he threw down his wrench and said, right, that's it, I'm leaving. And that's what he actually said. And he was so mad with anger literally mad, that he went to his room, washed, changed, packed his suitcase, and appeared on deck carrying his suitcases ready to leave. And the two girls, they almost fell off the boat laughing, because there was ocean all around as far as you could see. There's nowhere to go. It's okay to say, right, that's it, I'm leaving, but where are you going to go to? And apparently he just realized what he was doing, got totally embarrassed, red in the face, never said a word, but just turned around, went back into his cabin, changed into his work clothes, and went into the engine room to help. And they remained best of friends when they arrived. And it was just realizing that when you get angry, you're just totally irrational. Right there it said, I'm leaving, when there's nowhere to go. Fortunately, there was nowhere to go. So they had to make it work, which they did. And I often tell that story, if it's too easy to leave, then people don't actually face those unwholesome qualities, learn from them and transcend them. They had to work together. There's no other choice. And sometimes you say that in this wonderful yacht called Planet Earth. It's okay to say, right, that's it, I'm leaving. But where the hell are we going to go to? We have to work it out. We have to make it work. There's no choice. And so it's a nice little story. Just because unwholesome qualities start to arise, don't just leave. Find out solutions. Why are the unwholesome qualities arising in you? Find out, learn from it, investigate. So don't just go straight away. But if, you know, you've tried everything and the unwholesome qualities are really getting worse and worse and worse over many days, then okay, leave. But don't leave too early. Please explain the following Bojangas, Dhamma Vicaya and Pasadi. Okay, these are the seven enlightenment factors, both leading to enlightenment and what happens when you do get enlightened. Okay, they start off. Sati is the first one, mindfulness, and people don't know what mindfulness is because they think just anything is mindfulness, powerful mindfulness. Dhamma Vicaya, when you've got something like an unwholesome quality, you can hold it and understand it. Here we go, this is Dhamma Vicaya. What's this I'm holding up? What is it? Please, come on, contribute. Stick, what else? Word, yeah, please explain some more. Yeah, round. What else? What can you see? Yeah, what else? Keep on sort of explaining it to me, what you see. Yeah, what else? What else? Keep on looking. This is Dhamma Vicaya. But when you get rid of all the names, and when you can't actually think of anything to say, that is Dhamma Vicaya. Because all the names are not the thing. The names are actually just pointing to what this is. The trouble is we always look at the names and think stick, and think we've understood it. We think anicca, we've understood it. What the heck does anicca mean? That's just a name. What does it point to? So a lot of times when you hold up something, you say stick, you know, boy, monk, nun. It's not what I am. It's more to it than that. Donut. It's much more to it than that. But a lot of times that we just get stuck on the names and the labels, we don't see anything more. And we think that's Dhamma Vicaya. We think thinking is Dhamma Vicaya. No way. When the thoughts stop and you start seeing, that's Dhamma Vicaya. And when it gets to Pasadi, that's the tranquility of body and mind. So that Bojanga means you can sit still comfortably, not just with force, just the body doesn't move, it doesn't want to move, it's just quite happy. And that's why, you know, there was my former, the Abbot Ajahn Chakra. Now he gave a talk, he had a very, very calm body. And we had this video of him giving a Dhamma talk once. And just for fun, we played it fast forward. And he was still perfectly still. It was amazing to see that. Because usually if you take a video of you and fast forward, you're always jerking all over the place. But you know, when he was fast forward, he was actually still not moving. It was really interesting to see that. So that was kaya pasadi, the tranquility of the body. And the next thing is obviously tranquility of the mind, where the mind doesn't move. Stillness. Pasadi is also a beautiful, happy state. From kaya pasadi and chitta pasadi, tranquility of the body, tranquility of the mind, you get this beautiful happiness. It's like a freedom from jail happiness. Oh, I don't have to worry about this body anymore. So those are two of the enlightened factors. And obviously that's what we're practicing here. How did you spend your afternoon when you were a young monk? Did you meditate all afternoon until late at night? How did you allocate your time? You would meditate. We had the one meal of the day, finished about 9 o'clock. So you meditated. At 3 o'clock we had our chores to do. As always, I don't know why 3 o'clock, the bell went at 3, we did our chores and then we had usually a cup of tea? Sometimes we did, if we were lucky, but very rarely. And so then it's afterwards the showers, by the bathing, by the well. And then afterwards we have the evening meeting. That's how it was. So the afternoons were meditating and doing chores. That was in the old days. When you came here to Bodhidharma Monastery in the mornings, we would work and then we'd have our lunch because it was a bit later because of the people coming from town, and after lunch we'd work, and in the afternoon we'd work, and in the evening we'd work, and at night time we'd work as well. It was really hard to build this place. And if anyone was here, if anyone knew me at the time, we were always really, really working hard. You know, just 8, 9, 10, 11 hours a day, sometimes longer. It was really hard work. And at those days, we didn't even have a place to sleep at night. My first place to sleep, you know, was the door. I had a door to sleep on, no mattress. And we had two doors. The senior monk, Ajahn Jayakura, had the flat one, and I had the one with ribs on it. And I was much thinner in those days, and my bones protruded, so it wasn't very comfortable. But at least you had the hole in the middle, because they had these doors, they used to put the door hole in the middle, and I had one of those, so there was a big hole in the middle, but that was very handy to I didn't need to get up to go to the toilet at night. Yeah, I did, I was only joking. But I thought of that a few times, you know. It was very convenient. And from there, I had a tent, which was always soaking wet. The blanket was, they did have a mattress, but it was soaking wet all the time. And from there I graduated to my first stable residence, which was the water tank hut. You've got a picture in there, the water tank hut. And even that flooded during the winter time. So I had actually duck boards to get to my bed. And it really stank. So it was really tough in those days. Which is why I tell the young monks, when I was a young monk, we didn't have these nice huts like you have these days. We don't have this nice food. We don't have all this pampering like hot showers. We had cold showers out in the open in the evening when the wind blew. We didn't have time to... And the monks get fed up with that. It's true, it was really tough. We did a huge amount of work. Because we had no choice, there's no place to stay. And the first year we were here, we had very little support. And I was wondering afterwards, why not? And it was because many of the people here, even the Thais, they didn't trust us. Who were these two Western monks? You know, in particular, where they're going to stay? Why would you actually give donations to a monastery if they're going to sort of stay for a year and then just head somewhere else? But once, you know, they saw how hard we worked and saw we were good monks, especially keeping the precepts, being good monks, strict monks, and see how hard we worked, and then they started getting faith in us, and that's when they started supporting. But even then, you know, I did most of the building in those days, even that main hall. You know the main hall? You know who the builder was for that? Whose name is on the building license? Me, I built that. And nice story about that hall. And I'm quite, in a sense, I'm a bit upset to admit this, but it's also what happened in the end I was very proud of. And I tell the other monks, and if ever you have an argument with someone, this is how you should behave. Because when we designed that hall, I did much more building. So I knew actually how to build. I knew how to build a hall. But the other monk, Ajahn Chah, said, no, I don't want it this your way. We want it my way. And we had an argument. In about 2 weeks, we were really upset at each other. Because, he wanted to build it his way. I want to build it my way. And, of course, I know better than he does. I'm a builder. You know what it's like. You think always right. So one day, I came to my senses. And what we do in Buddhism, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. I came to my senses and I got a tray of candles, flowers, and incense. I went to his room and said, I want to ask forgiveness of you for arguing with you. And he was really taken with that. I said, wow, isn't this beautiful? This is what we should do as monks. I say forgiveness to each other. He forgave. He asked forgiveness of me for all the rotten things he said about me too. And then afterwards he said, thank you so much. It's very beautiful. And I said, but I want to ask a favor of you. And he said, what is it? With a bit of what are you up to? And I said, you're the senior. I want the hall to be built your way. And I agree with you, because I'm going to give up my views. And he said, that's such a noble thing to do. And he said, but I also want number two. I want to be the one who builds the hall your way. So it's about a year and a half's work, building a hall which I could have designed much better, building it somebody else's way. That's a very beautiful, wonderful thing to do. So I wasn't going to say, okay, you build it your way, go on. I'm not going to have anything to do with it. That's what most people do. They say, no way. I'm going to build it your way, and I'm going to do the building. And that's what I did. I still think it's the wrong way of building a hall. Wasted a lot of money, but I did it, and I was very happy to do things like that. It's not just asking forgiveness. It's not just letting someone else do it their way. It's you make it. You build it their way. Because the hall is not important. There's something else that's more important than building a hall. That's building this beautiful meditation and letting go and wisdom and compassion. So that's what I was really building. And that's more important than any hall. So that's how to overcome unwholesome qualities. In certain Buddhist practice, monks and nuns will have these prayers together with chanting lots of mantras to give out food to the spirits and deceased ones. How do the spirits and deceased ones benefit from these types of rituals?
Usually very little.
Sometimes that they can benefit, but it's very, very, very rare. But a lot of times the rituals are just so thick in Buddhism these days. So maybe at the end of the retreat we can share merits, with any deceased spirits. And the ones which you can share merits with are usually the ones which are close to you, mothers and fathers, people who just recently died. But a lot of those people are just really good people. They don't need many more merits because they've got enough. They've had a good life. Sometimes I say it's like sending a donation to Bill Gates. He doesn't need any money, he's rich. So a lot of times we send merits to our mothers and fathers, but they're doing pretty well. They've been good people, kind people. They don't need those things. So a lot of those practices, they're more for the people who've left behind, for those ones who are grieving for their mother and father. Not really for the mother and father, but we need to do something for them. That's mostly for us. That's why we do those chanting and rituals. Not for the ones who passed on. Because a lot of time those people who passed on, maybe there'd be a few days, 49 days, sometimes they stick around, but after a while they're gone. So, they've got a new life. So, it's kind of cute and nice and it's wonderful gratitude. Maybe 30 years, 40 years after your mother or father has died, you still, do a memorial service for them. Quite frankly, I don't think it would reach your mother and father after such a long time. But nevertheless, it's still a beautiful thing that you do. It reaches you, the one who does it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do we cultivate metta? Could you share some ways to cultivate it? I've already shared many ways. The best way is get the teddy bear, if you can find one. They're all very popular now. Find a teddy bear and hug it. How do you feel? That's metta. this kindness, this softness, this gentleness. That's metta. So actually you do that and say, what was that? You do things like helping somebody, opening the door for them, or you find they're late for their breakfast and you know they like noodles, you save some for them. This is for you. You know that they can't find a spoon and you find one for them. Little gestures like that are wonderful. And when you do things like that, somebody may be sick and you just go and find them a cup of tea or juice or something. That's what metta is. Just the other day that somebody was having a bit of an emotional time, so I made sure I found them some biscuits. In the afternoon, breaking the eight precepts. But metta is more important than eight precepts, quite frankly. That doesn't mean that you've got to go and have biscuits this evening. That was a special case. But this is like kindness and looking after yourselves. So you should be able to feel metta, but don't think metta. Don't try and sort of write out a dissertation on the meaning of metta. Don't try and intellectualize it. Feel it. And then another way you can do it, I mentioned this the other day, just here we go, metta. Listen to what happens after I say the word. Metta. 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 You say it enough times, soon you can feel it. You don't need to say it anymore. That's one of the reasons why that some of these chants I don't like doing, because there was one particular chant we used to do, Ajahn Chakra, we really liked it, about the four Brahmaviharas. And we would start to do this, I'd just get to metta, I'd get halfway through the first one, and I couldn't chant anymore. She said, it's incredible metta coming up. You said the chant, what is it? Metang sahagatena chetasa ekang disang paritawan. And just, I haven't done chanting for years. And just all this metta, because I was listening to what I was chanting. And the words were actually generating the metta inside of me. And you got halfway through and you're blissing out. I couldn't chant anymore. And so I said, it's a waste of time, you know. You just do the first verse and that's enough. Because you've got the metta really strong and it's wonderful. So that's what these words do. They point the mind, you know, to the signpost of the words. They point it to what metta means. And you've got the metta and that's all you need to do anymore. Ooh, that was really good fun. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, on the first day you shared one of the ways to let go, which is to give our time and effort for a good cause, without expecting any return. There were four ways you mentioned. Could you share the other three ways? The four ways of letting go. I gave many talks on that subject, and you know, all it came from is the first sermon of the Buddha, the Dhammacakka Sutra. And when it gets to the third noble truth, you know, the Buddha said, letting go of craving. And what is that? Chaga pati nisaga muti analaya. And those are the four ways. Chaga was giving, expecting nothing back in return. You're really letting go. If you give a donation expecting a tax receipt, or give it expecting acknowledgement, that is not giving. You're getting something back for what you're giving. And that's why that sometimes it's not money, it's just giving time, giving a smile to someone who's having a hard time, just being with them, talking with them, giving them a hanky if they're crying. Just, you know, giving quietness to somebody so that, you know, you don't bang the doors. Give them the gift of silence by not talking to them. Those are all incredible gifts. And, you know, now you are giving your time to meditation. But if you expect something back in return, you know it doesn't work. You're just giving, I'm giving this time just for the sake of just meditating. Don't expect anything at all. That's giving. And I mentioned that already, but the next one, pati nisaga, is throwing things away. It is literally meditating, not to attain things, but to let go of things. To understand what you mean in there, is we accumulate so much. I had the simile of my mother's shelf in an English person's house, actually most people's house. I have the shelves for knickknacks and for mementos. So the first time I from Australia, I went to visit my mother. You know, somebody said, well, you've got to bring something as a gift for her. So it was a little cuddly kangaroo, you know, a little soft toy. And I brought that to her, and she loved it. She put it right on the shelf in a prominent position, because when I left, it reminded her of her son and kangaroo Australia. So the next time I visited her, I got her a soft toy koala. And it became just almost like a tradition. The next time I got her a kookaburra, and then a platypus, and then a wombat. You know, just a soft toy. You get anything from these shops, and the disciples just got one for me. And so when I got the wombat for her, there was a problem. Because, you know, the shelf was full. And so she tried to put the wombat on the shelf, and the other animals fell off. And then she spent all this time trying to sort of balance all these little animals on this small shelf. I said, Mum, why didn't you throw those other animals away? They've been there for years now. I said, oh no, they're really important for me. I can't throw anything off. And I realised that's called nervous breakdown. You've got so much stuff in your head that things start falling apart. And I thought, that's not the way. So I said, just have a clear shelf. And a new animal comes in, you put that up there. And all the other animals you throw away, because then you can actually really appreciate the new one. When you have so many animals in there, you can't fit them in. You're attaching, and you can't even notice the new one. It's just all confused with the old ones. Now, they did that as a simile of like letting go, of actually throwing things out of Patinissaka. Only have one thing at a time, don't accumulate very much. But unfortunately, we have all of our memories. So many memories of the past that when we put this present moment in, we can't even see it. And things start falling off. Just like my mother's shelf, that's your mind. Got too much stuff in it. So just how about throwing away all the old stuff and just keeping this moment right now? Then you're really mindful. That's Patinissaka. You're abandoning things. Not keeping things. Trouble is, my poor old mum, sometimes I'm really mean to her. The first time I went back with the kangaroo, she had, you know, my degree certificates, you know, my degree from Cambridge, the BA and the MA. And she said, oh, what should I do with these? And I said, well, you don't need these. You know, I'm a monk, don't need these things. So I tore them up and threw them in the waste bin. And my mother just, you know, she didn't move at all. She just, you know, was quite equanimous. And then I was in the room reading something, and then, where's my mum? And I went into the kitchen. She had taken them all carefully out of the waste bin and was sellotaping them all back together again. I felt so disgustingly low and terrible. Because I was just thinking to myself, I'm a monk, I can let these things go. But they were important to my mother. And I was a stupid, arrogant young monk thinking, ah, let them go, not realizing how it would affect somebody else. I felt so terrible for that, still do, you know. But, you know, she managed to tape them all together again so she could keep them. But that's letting go, or throwing things away. But don't throw things away when it hurts other people. And the next thing is, what is it, Patinissaka, Muti. It's like freedom. And this is, I usually tell the story, I haven't told it, I told it in brief, the prison, where one of the monks went to teach in the prison, and one day they asked him, what's it like in your monastery? I won't tell the whole story because I've got lots of questions here. Compared to a prison in Australia, living in Bodhinyana Monastery is a hellhole, it's austere. You know, just every food goes in the bowl. We work, we don't have TV, we can't play sport. You know, I have to sleep on the floor, we don't have nice beds. And compared to a prison where they have 3 or 4 or 5 meals a day, and they have huge amounts of choice, they don't have to work, they can watch the TV and the movies, they can play sport, they have a wonderful time in prisons in Australia. And when he told him how austere a Buddhist monastery is, the prisoners, or one of the prisoners, was so shocked that their friend was staying in such a harsh environment compared to them, that the prisoner actually said, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" It was the time he was invited into jail. And only then the prisoner realized what they were saying and they all burst out laughing. But it's true. The life of a Buddhist monk or a nun is much more austere than if you're in jail. But anyway, why is it that in our monasteries, there's a waiting list of people trying to get in? In prison, there's a waiting list of people trying to get out. And so why is it that prisons are more comfortable, but still people don't want to be in it? Monasteries are austere, but people still want to join. And, you know, the answer was, and this is what freedom means, any place you don't want to be is called a prison. Any place you want to be, doesn't matter how austere, is called freedom. There's a wonderful little insight there, because if you're in this retreat and you don't want to be here, this is Jhana Grove prison for you. If you are in a relationship you don't like, you want to get out, your relationship's a prison. If you're in a job you hate, or if you're in a body you don't like, it's sick, it's ugly, it's hurting. If you don't like the body, your body feels like a prison. If you're in a monastery you don't like, it becomes a prison. How do you escape from the prisons of life? You don't need to change your partner, change your job, or even heal your body. Just change your attitude to want to be here. And if you want to be here, you're not in prison anymore, you're free. I mentioned that the other day when I was signing books in Indonesia. For about 5-10 minutes I didn't want to be there. And I felt the pain of being in a prison, surrounded by all these people, this big line stretching as far as I could see. Or what his signature, photograph, signature, photograph. I was in prison. And I thought, no, that is suffering. Let go, which means I want to be here. I want to do this. And a lot of my time, because, you know, you've seen it, you do things and just, what the heck am I doing this for? But I want to be here. And as soon as I want to be here, I feel totally free. Even if you're sick, I want to be sick. Then you're free. Because I'm here anyway, might as well want to be here. And then you want to be here, that's called freedom. Any place you are, any mind state, even if you're sloth and torpor, restlessness, if you want to be somewhere else, that is called suffering. Whatever you are, even if you know you're just watching this breath and the breath is not good enough for you, if you're happy to be here, this is good enough for me, I want to be here. Then you've got freedom, letting go. And the last of the letting goes, I've already mentioned, it's called anālaya, which means nothing sticks. It's the simile of the lotus. You get jhanas, it doesn't stick. You go crazy, it doesn't stick. As soon as the craziness is gone, there's no residue. As soon as the anger, no residue. As soon as someone calls you a stupid pig, it's already gone. Nothing sticks to you. Urine, Chanel number 5, nothing sticks to the lotus leaf. That's the other type of letting go. Great meditation today. So what? It's gone. Terrible meditation 5 minutes ago. So what? It's gone. Don't allow anything to stick to you. That's called letting go. The 4 ways of letting go. There's old talks about that you can get online, but it's really brilliant, and just, it's a part of the Dhamma, it's right there in the, you know, the 4 Noble Truths, the 3rd Noble Truth, but a lot of time people just pass over it and they don't see just how brilliant that is. During Dhana in Malaysia, I realized that many like to offer the monks Ang Paos after Dhana. Ang Paos means red packets. In Hong Kong it's called Lai Si. You show know that I know all these words because the donations are important to the monasteries. They don't know too many of these Chinese words, but all monks know Ang Pao or Lai Si. And if ever you're in Hong Kong and you want to take a photograph of monks, you don't say monks, say cheese. You don't say cheese, you say Lai Si. I'm only teasing you guys. How do you make a bunch of lawyers smile in front of the camera? fees. Ah, here we go. It's a nice little joke. I haven't told this for a while. There was in the mortuary. In the mortuary. And there was these three. Any people from Ireland here? Any Irish people? Uh-oh. Okay. Any Polish people here? Polish? Okay. Three Polish people. In the mortuary, on the slab. And the coroner, you know, had to sort of investigate. And asked the attendant, said, all these three people are smiling. Why? He said, this first Polish guy, he fell into a vat of whiskey, and he drank, and that's why he died. That's why he died with a smile on his face. Alcohol poisoning. And what about this second one? Well, this guy, you can see, is a bit old. You know, he went to the brothel and had sex and had a heart attack. But at least he died with a smile on his face. What about this third one? This third one was struck by lightning. Well, how come he had a smile on his face? Because he thought he was having his photograph taken. Okay. Anyway. So, what was it anyway? I forgot what the question was. What was the question? Anyway. Who cares anyway? Let's go to the next one. Dear Ajahn Rounders, I asked a question about my mother-in-law last night, about her and her temple. Well, after you answered my question, you added, well, at least she's not going to the casino and playing money, mahjong all day. That's what my own mum does. Oh, you see, I told you about psychic powers, how you can really... People ask one question, but we know what they're really asking. She's a gambler-holic. How do I help her? Help. Okay. If she goes to the temple gambling, I'm not sure what country this is, but in many countries, you know, like in Singapore, because you know, when they had the casino in Singapore, because I was helping with the BF, you know, they asked me, the government asked all these religious organizations, can you help with some of the legislation? Because they're going to have a casino, and you know, how can we make it minimize the harm? And of course, one of the things was to have family, community, or themselves ban themselves from the casino. So somebody's going to the casino and the money is running out, they're really a gambler-holic, either the family can actually apply to the casino and they're banned, they can't go in there. Or if it's the community, just like a, sort of the church or the temple, you can actually go to the casino manager and say, look, this member of our church or our temple, they're now losing all their money, so can you please ban them? And then they will. So they're prohibited from going in. Or sometimes they realize themselves and they sort of ask themselves to be banned. So you can actually stop it that way. And if it is because the mother is a gambler-holic and she doesn't really know what she's doing, that's the trouble with all addictions. We don't realize what's happening. And that's actually sometimes where we need to give that addiction, make sure she knows she is addicted and it is a problem. Because as soon as a person realizes it is a problem and it's causing suffering, then of course they'll do something about it. That's always the first step. But for many people, oh, it's not a problem. It's my money. I'm okay. And they don't realize what they're doing to themselves. So sometimes that's... I don't know if you have some friends, and if she's losing a lot of money, you know, get some big guys with tattoos or something and say, you've lost lots of money, and take her around the back and just scare her. Because I remember just one of the ex-monks, he said that when, you know, he was, so he grew up in Atlanta and, you know, Georgia in the United States. Now he's pretty old now, he's about 70 or so. And he said that when he was a young boy with his friend, they got a packet of cigarettes and they were smoking on the beach. And a policeman caught them, you know, for smoking. And he took both of them at gunpoint to the police station. And the kids were terrified. And the guy, the policeman who arrested them, told a sergeant behind the desk, who didn't even lift his head up, said, we caught these two young people smoking, what should we do? And the guy behind the desk, take them out the back and shoot them. And that was the last time. That was the last time this boy smoked. It cured him straight away. Okay, maybe a bit of abuse there, but at least it stopped him smoking. He was almost, you know, wet his pants. He probably did, because he didn't know the police were only just winding him up, trying to give him a lesson. You know, shouldn't do this. So sometimes those hard lessons can be really quite helpful. Sometimes your poor old mum, and see if you can just restrict her money or whatever. So, you know, she can, you know, just have no money to pay for these things. I don't know this. But she has to realize that it's a problem. And once she realizes it's a problem, then there's so many solutions you can have. But people always think that you can win. Monks can win. This is the story. I don't know what it is about monks and nuns, but this nun, a very famous nun, she was teaching a retreat in England. And after the retreat was finished, her driver, an Australian girl, and she spent a range retreat in Bodhini Island Monastery. So I checked up this story, absolutely true, that her driver took her, was going to Heathrow, and on the way stopped for lunch. Now, if you've been to, you know, UK, that many of restaurants are attached to pubs. You know, and this was old English pub, so they had to actually go through the bar to get to the restaurant. And so they had a nice meal, and the nun was finishing, because, you know, only eating once a day, she had to eat a bit more. And the driver had a few English coins left, you know, a few £1 or £2 coins. And there was one of these slot machines. In Australia, they call them pokies. In England, they call them one-armed bandits. You know the meaning? You pull the lever, put the coin in, pull the lever, and all these things go round. And this driver was just putting the coins in there just to get rid of them. Because, you know, it's not enough to go and change them for, I think, German euros, whatever it was. Or that time, Deutschmarks. It was still Deutschmark time. And so just getting rid of these things. And you just put a coin in when the nun came past. And this lady, Anya, she told this nun, said, well, you've got all the good karma, you pull the lever. And in a moment of lack of mindfulness, this nun pulled that lever. And she only did it once, that's all. And you know what happened? It was jackpot. Absolutely true, jackpot. And all this money came out onto the monk's robe, nun's robe. And thousands of pounds came out. And you know, she's not allowed even to touch money. And she was covered in it. And at that point, in the bar, in the pub, everyone went quiet. There's, you know, this really weird person, this nun, Buddhist nun, had just won the jackpot. And they were just, you know, were silent. And then the bartender rang the bell and explained to the nun it was a tradition and she couldn't ignore the tradition. Anyone who wins the jackpot has to buy a drink for everybody in the bar. And this Buddhist nun had to break every precept and buy whiskies, gin and tonics and beers and stouts for everyone in the bar. So, you know who that was? I don't mind telling you. It's because that was Ayakema. Yeah, that's Ayakema, this great known nun. You know, that's why, you know, please don't touch those machines, because you're going to win. That's a true story. It's really crazy stuff, but, well, it works. So, actually, okay. Oh, this is the one. Al Powers, that's the one I was reading. What's his other one I was reading? During Dharma in Malaysia, I realized that many like to offer the monks ang paos after Dharma. I thought monks weren't supposed to receive cash as part of the monastic rule. I personally know a nun who has bought her own car and received ang paos for her own personal expenses. Didn't the Buddha set these rules so that the monks and nuns rely and need the help of the lay people? What are your thoughts on this, and how best should I address this matter with the monk in my local temple? Thank you. Remember fish and chips when you're in Malacca. Actually, I'm going to Malacca in November. So whoever wrote that Malacca, next November I'll be there. November the 23rd or 4th or 5th or something. the conference in, was it XC Temple? What's it called, the old temple there? Anyway, what happens is that, you know, it's very clearly stated by the Buddha, don't offer the monks any money and the nuns any money either, which is why you don't do that to me here. Any money goes into the box. And you actually saw me when Trent came this afternoon, because it's usually on Friday morning we empty all the boxes, count it up and send it into town. So the Anagarika empties the box, but I have to be there with him, because you're the treasure before. Just, what's it called? Always two people empty donation box, never one, to stop temptation. It's, there's a word for it, it's, anyway, the right procedures, control or whatever it's called. Yeah. And anyway, so you don't touch it yourself, and you don't have much to do with it. But it's become the tradition. You know, you give money to monks, and it does actually spoil monks and nuns when they have their own money, because they can buy whatever they like. And you know, they do get cars, and you have that terrible case of Lumpur Nenkam, who, you know, was in a private jet and having millions, literally millions of dollars. And there was this one monk, he was the secretary for a very famous monk in Chiang Mai province. And because he was like the secretary, he would control who went to have interviews with this monk. And of course, he got kickbacks. And this monk, I think he, looking after this very famous monk for, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 4 years, you know, people would bribe him, because, can I see the monk? Well, he's very busy. You know, here's a, and you know, he got a lot of money. And After 3 or 4 years, he disrobed with $8 million in his bank. All kickbacks, because he had control over who would see this really famous monk, you know, Lupu Wen. And that was incredible what that does. And of course, he had so much money, $8 million, what do I want to be a monk for? And that really corrupts everything. So that's why, you know, at least, you know, we make it sure that don't offer money to monks or nuns. It goes in the box. And then, but if it does go in the box, I have a responsibility, and so do the nuns. If you give a donation, say for Jhana Grove, I've got to make sure it's used for Jhana Grove. That is my responsibility. I don't touch it, but I've got to tell the committee, you can't use that for, you know, the internet, or for your global conference. That was given for Jhana Grove. It has to be used for Jhana Grove. Because that's the other thing with donations. If you give a donation to a temple because they're doing a building and they use it to buy a car, that's not what I gave it for. So it's another rule there that we have to make sure that the gift is actually used for the purposes it's given. In fact, the Vinaya, you know, the rules actually state, if you say you give a gift for, you know, what we're doing, like the nun's cottage over there, I've got to make sure that it's used for that, because it is regarded as your money until it's used for the purposes for which you gave it. And it happened some years ago. There was quite a wealthy lady in Thailand who gave $50,000 to build a stupa in Bodhinyana. And so, you know, it was in the account. And then after a while, we just decided we didn't want to build a stupa, get too many people, too many basically tourists coming in. So I was the one, I went to Thailand, I went to visit her and said, look, I'm sorry, we don't want to build a stupa anymore. Do you want your $50,000 back? No, so, because you have to give it back to her. She gave it for a stupa. We weren't going to build a stupa, so she had to get the money back. But fortunately, she told us, oh, no, no, whatever you want to use it for, that's fine. But, you know, we were ready to give her $50,000 back, because that's what we have to do. So, you know, that is a sense of responsibility to our donors. So that's actually how we practice. It's much more than not receiving money. It's making sure that your donations to monasteries, which we are looking after, are actually used. And if not, then we have to give it back to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can do, but it shouldn't belong to the monks or nuns. You know, we've got quite a few cars over Bodhinyana Monastery. Actually, most of those cars people give to us instead of actually selling, and they actually give to the monastery. So we've got quite a few cars over there. But, you know, they belong to the Buddhist Society of West Australia. They don't belong to us, but, you know, we drive and look after them. Well, actually, the monks don't drive them, the Anagarikas do. So, yeah, they're over there. But there are just pretty simple cars. We don't have a Rolls or a Ferrari. Anything expensive. Because imagine if, like, you know, a monk... I was telling the story last night. There was a very wealthy man. He came to visit Bodhinyana Monastery in a Rolls Royce. So he parked in front of the kitchen, had a chat. And then one of the monks was going to give a talk in our Armadale group. It was a Tuesday night. And this man said, oh, I'll give you a lift. And so this monk turned up, you know, you go to the Armadale group, and this is a low socio-economic area. It's a poor part of Perth. And this monk turned up in a roller, and he came out of the Rolls Royce, and they never let him forget that anymore. He was so embarrassed. Even though he's just offering a lift, you know, it didn't really look nice having a monk being driven in a Rolls Royce car. Oh, the poor monk, he was quite innocent, but he just did the wrong thing. Sorry? I think he got a lift to come back, but, you know, just... So those are the sorts of things that you have to remember. Just, it's not just, you know, what you do, it's also how you look and just the impressions you give to people, because... One of my resolutions as well was I would never live, you know, in my little cave. My residence would be never more comfortable than the poorest of my supporters. Now, if I'm going to receive a donation from you, and I'm, you know, for the temple, and I'm living in more salubrious, comfortable accommodation than you are, it's embarrassing. I shouldn't do that. So that's why I live in just in the cave. It's very comfortable. And if you live in a house or a place worse than my cave, then I'm in trouble. I won't receive any dana from you. I will give you dana or whatever. But it's true that it's the... And the Buddha actually said this again and again. It's against the rules, and he said it's one of the reasons. He said, if anyone accepts money, it's not my disciple. It's not a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun. Made it very firm, but it's very hard to change that rule because so many monks and nuns accept money. Unfortunately, I don't know what to do, but at least as long as if the monks and nuns, if they accept the money, if they give it away or put it in the donation account, they don't have their own funds. If that was the case, I wouldn't mind, because I remember going to see Ajahn Sumedho's preceptor once, and he accepted money, but he had nothing. He gave it away all to the refugees, you know, who were in from Laos at the time. And I really respected him for that. You know, he literally, because he took me into the refugee camp, it was just after the Vietnam War, and there's lots of Laotian refugees. And all the money he'd got, you know, from the donations that day, he literally have it in his wallet and just turn his wallet upside down and give it to these poor refugees, and he'd go home with nothing. So that was the monk. He received money, but he didn't keep any of it. And that was actually nice and beautiful to see. But, you know, lots of monks, you know, the money is sticky. Once they keep it, they just want it.
It must be bad coming for the people who give as well.
It is, yeah, but sometimes that people who give, they don't know any better. And they think, well, if I give, you know, like I said the other day, give a bottle of whiskey to Ajahn Brahm, then my father up in heaven will be happy. Well, if we give lots and lots of money to holy monks, then, you know, if I give $100 to Ajahn Brahm, you know, that's where we're going to get a lot of merit from that. But if you give it to, you know, the monk at the end of the line over here, well, it's just a waste of $100. You don't know. That's the point. The monk at the end of the line over there, you know, he may be the totally fully enlightened. Anyway, my girl, crikey. What is the best response to those who make me feel like I've committed a crime and found when meat is served during dana? My answer, Buddhism wasn't a vegetarian, just isn't good enough. Help. Look, the response of people, they get critical of you. They got critical of the Buddha. So So it doesn't matter what you do. You can be vegetarian, vegan, you may not eat at all. And people say, you're killing carrots, you evil man. Those carrots have a right to survive. What did they do to be slaughtered like you? And they're not even cooked. You're chewing them alive. Don't you know what carrots feel like? Anybody, for any reason, you can always find reason to criticize. So people who actually criticize you, it says more about them than it does about what you're doing. So when people just criticize you, I don't feel like it's a crime. You just carry on, you just ignore them. How did your monastic practice change after your 6 months of solitary retreat? You know, I did 6 months, I didn't speak to one human being. Didn't see anybody for 6 months, just myself. It was very peaceful, very nice. But the problem was, I hadn't spoken for 6 months. And I stopped thinking. There were no thoughts going on. And then people were asking me, well, how was it? What did you do? I couldn't answer them. And I knew I had to. And so I really had to use effort to force myself to think, so I could actually answer and speak. And it, you know, took 3 days. I had a headache, splitting headache, because I had to force my brain to work again. Really awful. But it's great, you know, just when you don't have to think. There seemed to be more people talking in the cottages and in common areas than previously. You've committed a crime, you evil talkers. I personally like the silence. What are the benefits of a silent retreat? Maybe you should have a talking meditation retreat once a year for all the chatterboxes. Yeah, I mean, maybe we can have, like, you know, the you can actually put down on your registration where you really, 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 really want silence, and you go into the silent cottage, and then the chatterboxes go in the chatterbox cottage. And if you're in the silent cottage and you start talking, you get relegated to the chatterbox cottage. Yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it? Maybe we can do something about that. But no, look, there are some people on this retreat, you know, been meditating for years and they like silence. There's some people, if you make them silent, it feels just too oppressive. And it means that they just can't survive a retreat. So just anyone who, yeah, you like silence, but please be kind and compassionate to others. Other people, they need to talk. And they're doing really, really well. They've lasted this long. Remember that story I told about that woman suffering domestic abuse? And she snored during the meditation in Dhammaloka. And after people understood, they said, oh, no, you can sleep as much as you like. You can snore during my meditation. Because, you know, you need it. That kindness and compassion is so important. And if you have that kindness and compassion, people's voices, it's only last a little while when you hear them talking, but the talking which goes on in your head, they shouldn't be talking. I came on this quiet retreat. Why are they talking? You see that noise inside your own head? That is much more disturbing than what other people say. The echoes of other people's conversations, that is the problem, not their conversations. You're most circular. That's good. Not bad. Could you give us any tips, advice or strategies on how to adjust back into the normal world once the retreat is over? It's not over yet. You're already jumping ahead for a couple of days. Who knows, it may never be over. All those of you who come from Singapore overseas, there may be just floods in the airport. And the airport is closed down for a week. There may be a strike of pilots and you can't get home. There may be all sorts of things happening. You haven't left yet. Please live in the present moment. Get your money's worth. It costs a lot of money on this retreat. You don't want to give it up yet. You've got another day and a half to go. Squeeze everything you can get out of it. Crikey. I feel like I have accomplished a lot of quietening of my mind and senses, so I can imagine them winding up again. No, just wait for a while. The retreat isn't over until the last month. Okay, how many of you started packing already? Yeah, you should pack. Even if you're leaving tomorrow. You know, don't pack until an hour beforehand. The latest, or the earliest, whatever it is. Because it's amazing. People You spend all this time getting here, and you know it's so hard to get on a retreat, and now you're here and you're already thinking of leaving. So please, while you're here, stay here. Live in the present moment. I had another weird experience again today. A weird experience is great. I was seated and meditating as usual, but had no progress. So I tried visualizing a rabbit. It's Easter. Easter is rabbits. I tried visualizing a rabbit and having fun with him and hugged him. But after I did that, I experienced an overwhelming emotional feeling, like when you had sex. And that ecstasy feeling washed over. It started from the heart and slowly crept upwards. The feeling was so much that I just kept crying. It continued for a long while and went on and on before it subsided when I stopped thinking of the rabbits. That's actually quite obvious, because you know what rabbits are famous for? For having babies. And where do babies come from? You know, try something else, not a rabbit. Try kangaroo. What else? Like a crow? They're nice. Anyway, what do you got? Kept quiet. It continued for a long while, went on and so forth, it subsided, and I stopped thinking of the rabbit. Afterwards, for a while, I did nothing, and the mind was darkness, and it was somehow peaceful. It's the first experience for me, and I'm not sure why or what is happening. Can you please help? Yeah, it's rabbit meditation. So, well, somebody actually has a nice little joke. When rabbits take photographs of each other, do they give themselves rabbit ears? Interesting concept. You know rabbit ears? And you put your two fingers up when you're behind someone photographing? Do rabbits do that? Because they've already got ears. Okay, jeepers. It's really hard to make people laugh when they're in jhanas. So you got some loving kindness going up with a perception of a rabbit, which obviously you really like. So well done. So it's just developing the piti sukha, the joy and the happiness coming from loving kindness. It's excellent. Please do it again. Is right samadhi coming first, then right view, or we have to understand right view, then we can get right samadhi? You can do whatever you like, chicken or egg, which comes first. So sometimes chicken, sometimes egg. Sometimes your right view, sometimes right samadhi. For me, certainly it was meditation first, and then the view came afterwards. For other people, you know, they do precepts first of all, and then they get some samadhi, then they get view. Sometimes they have right view, they're very smart. And then they can get the precepts right. And so there's so many different ways. Dear Ajahn, I have a female friend, same age as me, suffering from a lot of frustration and depression. She is a Buddhist and has been changing from one monastery to another, often due to argument with the people there. She was a nun before. I tried to help her by bringing her to temple to listen to the Dhamma and meet more new friends. However, she made me very, very, very irritated by eyeing at my life and checked on me. How could I help myself to help her so that she can be out of her frustration and depression? Oh, I don't know. Books, someone who doesn't like going to a temple, let the temple go to her. So she can get on the internet. There's so many temples on the internet, so you can get all sorts of great talks from the internet. But if she's suffering from frustration and depression, change from one monastery to another, sometimes that's obviously she's got what we call fault-finding mind. So even as she went to see the Buddha's too bald. Or the Buddha's too perfect, or whatever it is. You can always find fault in anything if you have that type of mind. The story to really help her would be the too bad rich story. If you can actually listen to that and understand that. Sometimes you tell a person a story, they listen to it on a talk on the internet, or they read it in a book, and sometimes they're at the right place, the right time, it clicks, and they get the light bulb, and they feel, yeah, now I know what the problem is. But to me, that is a classic fault finder. Always having arguments with everybody. No one's perfect. And all she sees is the two bad bricks in the temples, the two bad bricks in you, her friend. And you're trying so hard. So maybe can you tell her that story? No, maybe she can understand it. With regard to past lives, can you experience this in dreams or only in deep meditation? You can experience these things in dreams, but it's not really sure. The dream is just so uncertain because the mindfulness is quite loose and low. So yeah, you can, but you don't really know whether that was you or not. That's why meditation is very clear and very reliable. Your examples of past life recollection were of humans. What about animals, insects or other realms? Would you have memories if you were an ant? You would have short memories of being an ant. So, do I know anyone who's had any memories of being a dog or being a fish or being... I don't know those. But it's mostly because that you have the language you've learned as a human being. It's easy to remember and understand previous lives as a human being. But if you were a dog, it'd be sometimes hard to get your head around like what it feels like to be a dog. But who knows? Especially if anyone likes sleeping a lot, then maybe you were a dog in your past life. Oh, okay, yeah. Did I tell that story? Yeah, okay. Okay. Well, yeah, maybe that... I can't remember exactly, but this time of night. But anyway, so who knows what you were before? And if you like eating out of a bowl, maybe, like the monks do, maybe that's why... living in a small little hut in the back of people's gardens. That's what dogs do. Anyway... Having one life of memory is troublesome enough. Is it really good to be bombarded with many life memories and emotions? Yeah, it just serves the purpose of actually getting the bigger picture, getting all the information. You're not bombarded, you can let it go whenever you want, but at least you know that you existed before, and you know exactly why you are who you are and why you do what you do. Also, what if someone comes out of jhana in the middle of a burning fire, or submerged in water, you just go back into jhana again until the fire goes out. So even if one is protected within the jhana, he or she will be back to normal straight afterwards. And they say, it's a bit hot in here, just go back again. Wait till it cools off. Obvious. Thanks. How accurate is hypnosis? What if it's not accurate and we go through all these emotions for nothing? At least if you go through those regressions, it's been well proven that it may not be a past life, it may be imaginary, but the problem is solved. It's a catharsis happens. Whatever the problem was before, in this case anorexia, if it's some other problem, such as, again, a phobia, like if being confined in places of sharp objects or whatever, those phobias tend to get far, far less and maybe even totally sort of overcome. So the evidence is very strong with people who have gone through these regressions. It actually works. They get far healthier afterwards than they were before. So whether it's past life or not, at least it works. And for some people, it is their past life because they check it out. You don't have to worry. I know it's raining, but if you get into jhana here, it won't flood. We're on top of a hill, so the water will go down. And it's so wet in here, you're not going to get in a fire. So don't be afraid. Your jhana this evening will be perfectly safe no matter what time you get out. Guaranteed. I love this story. Mary walked on a street and she met her friend Sue. Hi, Sue. How are you? Hi, Mary. I'm fine, thank you. How's your son, John? He's still unemployed. He's so lazy. He likes to do nothing, but thank God, he went to Ajahn Brahm's retreat. Now he likes to meditate. At least he does something now. Okay, that's not bad. When practicing present moment awareness, is it necessary to focus your breath on one pointedness? No. When present moment awareness, whatever's happening now, sometimes it can be your breath, sometimes it's not your breath. What's happening right now? That's what you watch. Could be your breath, it could be sound, it could be feelings in the body, whatever. As long as it's happening now. It's not a replay of past events, it's not a going forward into the future and seeing what's happening, a preview of coming events. It's what's happening right now. Live. Dear cinnamon donut. Favorite flavor. Cutie pie, angel face. This must be for somebody else. Come on. Apple pie, okay. Angel cake. Anyway, let's just say hypothetically, okay, what are we going to here? Let's just say, hypothetically speaking, if a straight celibate male was starting to become gay, how would that work? I mean, they're celibate anyway, so what's the difference and why not? You usually encourage us to do things differently. Try different ways of doing things. Be adventurous, curious, creative, and informative. No, just be nothing. Don't be a gay. Don't be a straight. Just be like the donut. And nothing in the middle. That's the best way. So anyway, just you know, people, they want to be this, they want to be that. I like being a nobody. Nobody's perfect. We are aware of what we are ready for and can handle it. If I know all these memories from hypnosis and take it as me, then I go neurotic. No, you don't. The Buddha remembered all his memories. Did he go neurotic? He became enlightened. So we have all these ideas. Oh, this is terrible. If I do this, terrible things are going to happen to me. They don't. That's paranoia. You don't go neurotic. You know, you actually become wise and compassionate if you remember your past lives. Try it. And if I'm wrong, you can tell me I told you so. But if I'm right, you don't go neurotic, I will tell you, I told you so. Do we choose our parents? Yeah, just like you choose your car, but sometimes you choose an old bomb. Do you choose your partner in life? Do you always get it right? So you choose your partner like you choose your parents, but some, oh God, what did I do that for? So that's why, you know, if you choose your parents, sometimes you don't always get the right ones. You make bad choices sometimes, just like choosing partners. You make bad choices, which is why that you know that sometimes the relationships end. But as I was saying in Indonesia a couple of days ago, and I say in Australia, we don't call that divorce anymore. When a relationship ends, what do we call it? Recycling. It's a much better word than divorce. So you don't say, I'm going through a divorce, I'm going through a recycling. Which is more to the point. There we go, more past life stuff. If a person re-experiences a very early memory of a baby or a past life, can one read words or interpret the experience when one was a baby with a current literate mind? Good question, the answer is yes. In other words, you're experiencing a baby, but you have the mind of an adult. I.e., if as a baby someone saw a word in the recollection of their early life, would they understand that word in the recollections of a baby that didn't at the time? Yeah. So, you know, you have the mind of an adult, but it's through the body of a baby. So you've got all the information the baby can't understand, but you can. If someone keeps dreaming the same dream, is it possible past life comes through a dream? What's the difference with deja vu? Thanks, Ajahn. If you keep dreaming the same dream, it means you're sleeping too much. Wake up. Is it possible past life comes through a dream? Unlikely. What's the difference with deja vu? I remember reading some articles on psychology of deja vu. Most deja vu is actually that, you know, once you see that new thing, which you say, oh, this is deja vu, actually you project back that you've seen it before. But it's not deja vu at all, it's just a trick of the brain. Because, you know, sometimes I remember having deja vu in a place and it was only just recently been built. But it felt like that. It could not have been deja vu. Because what's happening, you're going through an experience and the mind starts to imagine it's seen that experience before. It's not you haven't been there before. Sometimes it's impossible to have been there before. But you get this feeling that you were. It's a trick of perception, that's all. Thank you, Ajahn. Got it. Understand. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What have you got? Is it Ebola? Is it bird flu? Please let me know what you've got before you write questions like that so I can wash my hands after I touched it. Well, it sounds good anyway, whatever you've got. Dear Ajahn Brahm, are the gates meant to keep the kangaroos out? I say, let's open the door of our heart gates to the cuddly kangas. Have you ever tried cuddling one of those? They're full of ticks. And if they eat all the grass, we can practice loving kindness and sow more grass for them to eat. Hee, hee, hee. They just pull all the grass up. And there's acres and acres of grass out there. Why do they have to eat the grass which I planted? Mean kangaroos. Now this is war. These kangaroos aren't going to outwit me. I am going to win. They might have won the first battle, but they ain't seen nothing yet. Kangaroos, be careful. Ajahn Brahm is on the warpath. Now, we'll see what happens. It's great if someone is able to rub the Tibetan singing bowl at 11 o'clock so no one missed lunch. Further, no one needs to keep on checking the time. If it's lunchtime yet, yeah, you can rub the bowl if you like. But sometimes people are very hungry by 11 o'clock, so they will ring the bell at 10 to 11 because they want it earlier. But yeah, you can do that if you wish to. Dear Ajahn Brahm, having few friends and being lonely as a kid, I made friends with the TV. I have struggled for years with a TV addiction. When alone, tired, stressed, it's not hard to spend half a day in front of my old pal, the TV. I'm not the only one who uses it, so can't ditch it. I would like to be able to be free of this addiction. Please help. Ah, what can you do to be free of the TV? Watch bad programs, that's a good idea. Sorry? Make real friends, that's very nice, but real friends aren't as good as TVs. You can turn TVs off whenever you like. Some people, they keep on talking, 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 and you don't know where the button is to turn them off. Well, watch Ajahn Brahm on YouTube. That's better than a TV. Yeah, okay. Any other ideas? Because I don't know that TV is designed to draw people in. And psychologists, they pay psychologists a lot of money to make the TV just very, very alluring. So one thing you say when you're alone, tired and stressed, if you can just look at the loneliness, the tiredness and the stressedness and try and get rid of those, then the need for a TV is gone. So that getting friends, but do some meditation. When you meditate and you get very peaceful, your stress disappears, you get happy, you're happy by yourself, you don't need a TV. But you know, I was staying in a hotel once on a retreat with the Buddhist Fellowship. And Angie asked me in public, Ajahn Brahm, did you watch the TV? And you know, monk, I have to be honest, I say, yeah, I watched the TV. And I say, it was very, very fascinating. Because I never turned it on. But I watched it. And if you watch it without turning it on, you can actually see your reflection. You can see who you really are in the glass of the TV. This is the old TVs. I don't know, can you do that in these new TVs? No, you can't. Okay. But yeah, if you watch a TV and don't turn it on, then that is really interesting. So tell this person, yeah, you can watch a TV, but don't turn it on. And then you'll see your reflection. You'll see who you really are. Ajahn, my mother is trying to sell her home. Unfortunately, there's been some upsetting negative energy in the last few years. How do you suggest to get better balanced positive energy back to the house so it will sell? Thank you kindly. You can invite the monks and the nuns there. You can put a sign in, as blessed by Ajahn Brahm. And then you can actually charge a few extra $1,000 for it. Would that work? Because some of the stuff which I, you know, had my cushion was actually auctioned in Hong Kong. And that sold how much? It's about $30,000 US. My cushion, my meditation cushion. So please keep away from this. Can you put this in the safe tonight? So you've got some negative energy in there. But what you can do is, because you know, sometimes people do this in houses, call it haunted house and charge people to visit. Because they do that. We have this jail over in Perth, Fremantle Jail. It's a terrible place, but now it becomes a tourist place. So you can have people actually, they pay to be locked up at night. They give them these prisoner clothes and they just pretend, role play, being a prisoner for a day so they know what it's like. And people pay money for that. You know, so if it really is a haunted house going negative energy, just, you know, that's a great business for you. So if the haunted house, I don't know where this is, maybe it's in Singapore. Singapore would be brilliant. You get a lot of money. If you had a haunted house in Singapore and you had it as like a tourist attraction, you know, people in Singapore, they're so scared of ghosts, but they would really love going in there and having a look, see what it's like. And you could actually, you know, you put in a few little tricks in there, just a bit of visual effects, special effects, just to make it interesting for people. And then, you know, you can make a fortune, so you don't need to sell the house. So tell your mum, sort of, you know, you take on her home, and the upsetting negative energy in there, that would be the selling point for actually for a business. So make a business case for the haunted house of Singapore, and then eventually you'll be able to sell your home to another business or company, the Tourist Board of Singapore, and you double what it was worth. Anyway, that's an idea. I'm full of ideas at this time of night. Mostly silly ones. Today, or just do some chanting, get the restless energy out, the negative energy out. Today I had a restless mind. I asked myself what I wanted to do, and I had a beautiful walk in the bushes. The mind was silent. I enjoyed different shades of green and drizzling sound of rain. The gravel path was good, not slippery. Thanks to everybody who take care of Jhana Grove. Excellent. But you worked with your mind. When you are restless, you know, it's a great thing to do. I said, ask your mind, what do you want? Whatever your mind says, do it. And then you're working with the mind. You're a friend to your mind. And if you make friends with your mind will like to stay with you, have a very peaceful time. Very good. Last night you described how St. Teresa of Avila probably experienced jhana and did this with surrendering herself to God. Strong love and faith in God obviously played a big role. Since as Buddhists we don't relate to God in this way, could you suggest another way to rouse similar levels of love and surrender? Just to the Buddha, you're just giving a gift of 1 hour, 2 hours to a Buddha. You're meditating maybe for your mother who passed away, because she'd be just happy that you're meditating. And that way you're surrendering. You're not trying to get something for yourself. You're trying to let go of things. E.g. towards the qualities of the Triple Gem, yes. These we see in our teachers or through practice of metta. I have a feeling love is the heart of the path and practice. Yes, very good. What is the cause for hearing the true Dhamma, having a pair of ears? How do we differentiate between true and false if it's subtle in display? By what comes out of the Dhamma? If the Dhamma causes peace and happiness, stillness, harmony, then it must be Dhamma. If it causes anxiety, anger, more tension, less peace, it can't be the Dhamma. That's how you distinguish between false and real Dhamma. Is there something called Animitta Samadhi in the sutras? Could you please explain a little bit about it? Is what you have been teaching us? No, it's not what you've been teaching us. That is very, very difficult to understand. It's basically when you don't give anything a name. You don't describe anything, so there's nothing to actually to be a signpost for anything. And that way you've got no control at all. You let go. You've got no other way to let go. And then there's nothing there for your mind to cling on to do anything. So you have to be totally let go and still. That's a very difficult thing to do. Now, the Buddha was doing that, but it's very hard. OMB. Oh my... What is that? OMB? Oh my Buddha. Okay, and I'll tell you, because that's in text speak. OMG is oh my God. So OMB must be oh my Buddha, I suppose. I don't know. Is it just me, or has the meal gotten more and more delicious? So meditation so far, but today food went into my mouth and it was like explosion. What are your thoughts, dear Ajahn Donut? Yeah, this is actually true. This is what happens because you're getting more and more sensitive. More still, more mindfulness, more sensitive, and the food begins to taste much, much better. If there's nothing in us and everybody is just nature going, then why do we have to live, to work, or to practice meditation in the first place? Because there's no one in there, you've got no choice. If there was someone in there, you have a choice. There's no one in there. So you've got no choice. So you have to work. End of story. If we see nothing, then there's no difference whether we are enlightened or delusional. So why do we have to strive? Again, because you've got no choice. To strive or not to strive. This is just what you do. You have no choice in the matter. So just shut up and strive. What about your most roundness? If you sin as nothing, then why do you work so hard? That's a good point. I'm going to bed. Compassion and conditioning. Why do you still want to teach us to get enlightenment? I don't. I have to. I'm forced by my teacher's conditioning. Does it make a difference whether we are enlightened or delusional? Of course it does. So sometimes questions like that mean you're thinking too much and practicing too little. Can we transfer merit to people who are still living? I've been doing that all this last week. My merits I've been transferring to you by teaching, by being kind. Bianca's been transferring her merits of her cooking to you. So everything we learn, we do, we grow, we share with others. That is transference of merits in real life. Do we practice less controlling and less expectation in real life situation in work? You can do less controlling, but you still have to do some controlling in your work. Somebody asked me interviews, look, what you're doing here is not how you will practice once you go to work. So you don't do slow walking when you're trying to catch the bus. You don't just watch your breath when you're driving the car, you watch the traffic. So what you do here and what you do in other parts of your life is different. Here you're learning how to meditate. Yet, once you learn how to rest, when you're working, you can take rest. So during the middle of the day to re-energize yourself. So you can make use of this. You can, when you get sick, you know how to heal your own sicknesses. There's so much you learn here. But what you're actually doing here is not what you do when you are in front of the computer terminal at your office. Regarding offerings to the monks and nuns, usual practices, food and daily requisites. There is a school of thought. Here we go again. It's the people who write the same questions. There's a school of thought that says we can offer ang pao too, as money is the precious stuff. By doing so, it is like practicing offering of our precious stuff to the Sangha. May I know what is your opinion on this? Okay, well look, because, you know, tradition, you can offer ang paos to the monks and nuns. I'll give you special permission to do that. But you can offer red packets, as long as you don't put any money in it. Just offer the ang pao, and then you feel happy in tradition. And instead of putting money in the ang pao, put a little note saying, thank you, teacher. Or put a little ang pao in there saying, it's been a wonderful retreat. So give what is very precious, gratitude and thanks. Give forgiveness. Put a little forgiveness in an ang pao. Ajahn Brahm, I forgive you for all your bad jokes. So you can give ang paos, but put something different in there. And when you give ang paos to a monk over in Singapore or Malaysia or somewhere, put little ang paos, little pieces of paper in there, saying, you are too lazy. Or, I don't know, you can't put that in an ang pao. But give a nice gift. Say, thank you for all of your hard work. Thank you for teaching me. Give something which is even more important than money. You put the money in the temple box. But the monks and nuns give your thanks, kindness, gratitude. Lastly, dear Ajahn Teddy Roundness, is it true that arahats do not smile? People have that idea that once you're fully enlightened, you have horizontal, no emotions at all. But no, the arahats have the positive emotions, the kindness, the joy, the happiness. And I've said that story about the Buddha smiling many times and in the suttas there. So the Buddha did smile. So the Buddha was an arahat. Arahats smile. But what arahats don't do,
They don't scowl. They don't get angry. They so they don't sort of show the negative emotions. That's the difference. Positive emotions, yes. Negative ones, no. Yay! I've finished. If I went past your questions too quickly, I didn't answer them thoroughly, I do ask your forgiveness. And if I did go on a bit longer, because it's 9:40 now, no worry, you can always catch up with your sleep when you're in your coffin. Right now, it's only a day and a half to go to get enlightened. And if you don't get enlightened, people will ask you when you go back home, how did you do, on the retreat? And if you say, I had a good sleep. So see what happens. So thanks again. I don't know. The future's uncertain. Just live in the present moment. I'm not answering questions now. That's enough. Yes, we are. Yeah, I'm here tomorrow. Sadhu. 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 Okay. Thank you again for listening. I do try hard to make you happy.